Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach, and this edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 22nd of July. These are our main stories. The comedian and the rock singer is another maverick about to join Ukraine's President Zelensky and bring change following a snap election. Violence in Hong Kong as pro-democracy protesters march on Beijing's headquarters. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, defies the country's top prosecutor. Also in this podcast...
No, I'm sure I'm not going to be sacked because I'm going to resign before we get to that point. I intend...
Really?
Assuming that Boris Johnson becomes the next Prime Minister.
Just days before Britain gets a new PM, the man in charge of the public finances says on live television he can't work with a boss who's ready for a no-deal Brexit. Earlier this year, Ukraine elected a comedian, Volodymyr Zelensky, to be president. 3 months later, could a rock star become his coalition partner? Exit polls suggest Mr. Zelensky's Servant of the People Party performed well in parliamentary elections held on Sunday. But for him to secure a majority in parliament, he could have to work with others. Enter the singer Sviatoslav Vakarchuk, who, like President Zelensky, has recently entered politics to create a new party, Voice. Mr. Zelensky has now invited him for talks. The president thanked his supporters.
I would like to thank everyone. My congratulations to everyone. It's a good, strong, symbolic result. I would like to have done a bit better, but we are very grateful. Me in particular, every one of us, we are grateful to the people of Ukraine for their support. Thank you. Let us applaud the people of Ukraine for their great trust in our party, in the Servant of the People.
President Zelensky called the snap election to try to sweep away established parties which had left millions of Ukrainians living in poverty, failed to stop Russia's annexation of Crimea and end the conflict with the Kremlin-backed separatists. To get anything done, he has to share power with the Ukrainian parliament, which nominates a prime minister and forms the government. Sviatoslav Yorash, who's 23, is expected to become one of the president's MPs. He says he and others want to change Ukraine.
Ukrainians are not willing to trust the old elites that have lied and tricked them so many times in the past. And they're willing to give us a chance to try and change the country for the better. We are coming from various walks of life, but we have our expertise in different areas. And we'll be trying to put it all together to transform this country anew.
My colleague James Kumarasamy spoke to our correspondent Steve Rosenberg, who's in the capital Kiev, covering the election.
Well, according to what's called the national exit poll in Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky's party, Servant of the People, has secured around 44% of the vote. That's well ahead of the four other parties which are predicted to make it into the new parliament. If you look down the list, the next party down is what's called the Opposition Platform for Life, which is a pro-Moscow party. That's set to get around 11.5%. European Solidarity, which is the party of the former president, Petro Poroshenko, 8.9%. So you can see that Servant of the People is well ahead. But to form a government, the party may well require a coalition partner. And I say may well because the makeup of the new parliament still isn't clear. Half the seats are decided by party lists, and that relates to the exit poll we've been talking about. Roughly the other half are decided by individual first-past-the-post contests between individual candidates in electoral districts. It'll take some time for those to be known.
And there's a possibility, is there not, that if a coalition is needed, it could be between a party of a president who comes up through the television comedy world with a rock star.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most likely option for a coalition, if it is needed, would be between Servant of the People and a relatively new party called Holos, or The Voice, which is led by Ukraine's most famous rock star, Sviatoslav Vakarchuk. And I think that's a reflection, again, of all these new faces we are seeing in Ukrainian politics. Ukrainian voters seem to be disillusioned in the old way of doing things, the old style of politics. That is why Volodymyr Zelensky was elected by a landslide 3 months ago. That is why his party has done well in the parliamentary election. And is also why Vakarchuk's party, The Voice, seems to have cleared the 5% threshold and will be represented in the new parliament.
So a possible multimedia coalition. But what are the priorities now for Mr. Zelensky, now that he seems to have got a pretty strong backing in parliament to go with his presidential win?
Yes, well, with this level of support that he's got in parliament, I think he will consider this a mandate to push ahead with his reform programme. And both the president and his party say they want to do all sorts of things to shake up Ukraine and the political system, the economic system, the legal system. They're talking about passing a law against illegal enrichment by Ukrainian officials. They're talking about removing MPs' immunity from prosecution. There's also talk about a law on presidential impeachment, electoral reform. There's a long list of reforms that President Zelensky says he wants to carry out. Having said that, he does have his critics. There are people in Ukraine who believe he's too close to a powerful tycoon, Igor Kolomoisky. Now, the president denies that, the businessman denies that too. There are sceptics who believe that, well, we've seen it all before. We've seen people who've come into power and believe that they can reform the country and nothing's come of it. But I think the election results seem to indicate that for now, many Ukrainians want to keep faith in this showman president and in his party.
Steve Rosenberg in Kiev. Police and protesters have clashed in Hong Kong outside China's central government office as mass demonstrations against the authorities intensify. They're calling for political change and the resignation of Hong Kong's chief executive Carrie Lam, who was forced to suspend a bill that would have allowed extraditions to mainland China. Graffiti was sprayed on the China central government offices, calling President Xi Jinping a dog. Speaking at a rally, Bonnie Lung from Civil Human Rights Front said Mrs. Lam must listen to the protesters.
Hong Kong people had been voicing out our five demands for so many times, including the march where 2 million people already took to the streets peacefully, voicing out these five demands, advancing these five demands. However, unfortunately, the Carrie Lam government still isn't doing real actions about our demands.
Demonstrators, many dressed in black and wearing masks, defied official orders and marched beyond the agreed endpoint of a rally to make their way towards the Beijing liaison office. Riot police used tear gas and pepper spray and charged protesters with batons to try to disperse them. Our reporter Danny Vincent was close to the liaison office.
What started as peaceful protests have again descended into chaos when thousands of protesters surrounded Hong Kong's Beijing liaison office. Police stood off against protesters. They warned the crowd before firing tear gas, but it hasn't been enough to disperse the crowd. They've confidence in numbers. Some are armed with makeshift shields and sticks. They made human chains to protect those who wanted to leave, but tensions remain high in this corner of Hong Kong. Neither side appear willing to step down.
And our correspondent Stephen McDonald followed protesters throughout the evening.
There's now a standoff with the riot police waiting to move against a group of remaining protesters here. This is like technically an illegal gathering, and they've been throwing some projectiles at the police. There are strong lights being shined this direction by the police. I think they're potentially trying to identify which protesters are throwing things at them. And so it's a very tense situation, and it's what we've come to expect, though, now from Hong Kong, these protests. They start off as a mass peaceful rally, and then they tend to turn into this, where, you know, the hardcore protesters, if you like, those who think that the peaceful way hasn't worked, they're really taking it up to the authorities, even though they face potentially even being thrown in jail or injury. They think this is the only way to guarantee Hong Kong's freedoms and to somehow or other secure democracy for this city.
So can the crisis in Hong Kong come to a peaceful end? Here's our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
When these protests began about 7 weeks ago, they wanted something very specific. That was the withdrawal of an extradition bill, which was proposed by the authorities in Hong Kong. It would have made it easier to send criminal suspects to mainland China. The authorities in Hong Kong heard the protests and they suspended the bill, but they didn't withdraw it, which is what the protesters wanted. So they carried on turning up on the streets. What happened then, though, is that certain other grievances got wrapped up in the protest movement. Some of those are quite local. The Hong Kong people are quite angry at mainland Chinese people coming over, buying medicines and goods such as that, taking them back to mainland China and selling them at a profit. So very local issues and wider issues such as universal suffrage. You know, Hong Kong people are now saying, a lot of these protesters, we want more say over how we run our lives.
And the broader the issues motivating the protesters get, the harder it is for the authorities to actually address them in any meaningful way.
It is, yes. The leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, a few weeks ago said again that the extradition bill is dead, again without formally withdrawing it. She hoped that, I'm sure, would have ended all this and kind of kept it narrowly focused on this one issue. But that isn't how it's turned out. And it's difficult to know now how it's going to play out.
So China is hoping that the protesters get bored or at least feel they're not achieving anything by continuing to turn out every Sunday. If they don't, will we come to some kind of flashpoint where China says, look, we've got to stop this?
That's always a possibility. If people die during a protest, if it gets even more serious than it has, and of course we've just heard there that there have been quite violent protests today, or there could be something which sparks a response from Beijing. In today's protests, what you've seen is that demonstrators have gone to the Chinese liaison office in Hong Kong. That's the seat of Chinese power in Hong Kong, and the symbol for many protesters of the frustration they feel towards Beijing and Beijing's squeezing of their rights and freedoms.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, says he'll seek an urgent judicial review of a report by the public prosecutor which found he misled Parliament over a campaign donation. He staked his reputation on fighting corruption. From Pretoria, our correspondent, Andrew Harding.
President Ramaphosa was scathing about the claim that he deliberately misled Parliament last year. At the time, he denied receiving campaign funding from a controversial company, but later said he'd been misinformed. His critics have called for him to step down until the matter is resolved. But Mr. Ramaphosa told a news conference he would carry on, and he vehemently rejected the public protector's serious allegations as fundamentally flawed and wrong in law.
The report contains numerous factual inaccuracies of a material nature. The findings we have found are wrong in law, are irrational, and in some instances exceed the scope of the powers of the public protector. Furthermore, in failing to provide me with an opportunity to comment on the proposed remedial action, the public protector has violated the provisions of the Public Protector Act, the Constitution and the principles of our common law.
Not for the first time, it will now be left to South Africa's overworked courts to resolve what many here believe is fundamentally a political dispute.
Our correspondent Andrew Harding. The German airline Lufthansa has resumed flights to Cairo hours after joining British Airways in announcing they were being suspended. BA has cancelled services to the Egyptian capital until Friday because of unspecified security concerns. From Cairo, Sally Nabil.
The decision by British Airways has caused confusion here. The Egyptian authorities have given no indication about what could have prompted it. BA has confirmed that flights will resume next Friday. The regional manager of BA, Sharif Barsoom, in Cairo, told me the decision did not mean that there were security loopholes in Cairo International Airport. He said UK security checks had been carried out at the airport a few days ago, and the rating was excellent. But passengers are not convinced. They complain about a lack of information. Some of them say if the airline has security concerns about Egypt, why hasn't it shared details with its customers? An Egyptian woman in Cairo told me her daughters were due to arrive from London later in the week after being given transit flights. She now feels uncomfortable about the whole journey and hopes nothing goes wrong. Other passengers have been complaining that alternative routes can take up to 20 hours instead of the 5-hour direct flight.
Sally Nabil in Cairo. Still to come in this podcast.
Old people have to care of more olden people. You have to earn some money to help. So no more free time for me, right?
Japan's aging crisis. We'll hear about the challenges facing women from one family in Tokyo. Now, all the indications are that Boris Johnson will succeed Theresa May to become Britain's new Prime Minister on Wednesday. Already, the Finance Minister or Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, has said if that happens, he'll resign from the government. Mr. Hammond disagrees with Mr. Johnson on Brexit and says Britain leaving the European Union without a deal would be a catastrophe with dire economic ramifications. The BBC's Andrew Marr asked him if he thought he'd be sacked under a Johnson premiership.
No, I'm sure I'm not going to be sacked because I'm going to resign before we get to that point. I intend,
really,
assuming that Boris Johnson becomes the next Prime Minister, I understand that his conditions for serving in his government would include accepting a no-deal exit on the 31st of October. That is not something I could ever sign up to. It's very important that a Prime Minister is able to have a Chancellor who is closely aligned with him in terms of policy, and I therefore intend to resign to Theresa May before she goes to the palace to tender her own resignation on Wednesday.
I can never remember a Chancellor of the Exchequer, or indeed another senior minister, announcing his resignation live on national television. A moment, I suppose.
But can I ask, it's a first, Andrew.
Can I ask you, when it comes to Theresa May's final Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, will you be sitting on the front bench or the back benches?
I'll be sitting on the front bench. I intend to resign after Prime Minister's questions, before the Prime Minister goes to the palace.
So you are going to go onto the back benches and you're going to campaign, along with other former cabinet ministers, I hear, to stop no deal happening.
Yes, to stop no deal happening on the 31st of October without the consent of Parliament. Look, this is a parliamentary democracy, and if the new Prime Minister can persuade Parliament to vote for a no deal exit, then I will have to accept that. This is a parliamentary democracy. But we can't have wheezes like suspending Parliament or proroguing Parliament in order to deny Parliament its voice. This matter must be decided in Parliament.
Our political correspondent Chris Mason told me this announcement on television is a sign of further turmoil.
We've got used to British politics not being entirely conventional in recent years, and this was the latest case study of that. And this is the start, I think, of a week where everything will change in British politics, and perhaps nothing will change at all, because the old establishment, the likes of Philip Hammond, will become the new rebels. A crowd-pleasing showman who's spent a career sort of throwing rocks at the leadership will become, in all likelihood, the leader himself, with the expectation that Boris Johnson will become British Prime Minister by Wednesday afternoon.
And could Philip Hammond and the members of Parliament who agree with him on Brexit cause Boris Johnson serious problems?
That is the big question, and the answer is yes, they could. Why? Because they are passionately opposed to the idea of the UK leaving the European Union without a deal, something that Boris Johnson is willing to contemplate. And secondly, for the simple mathematical fact that remains unchanged from Theresa May's time as British Prime Minister, which is that the governing Conservative Party have barely got a majority to speak of, and therefore each potential rebel has turbocharged power because you don't need many of them to leave the government in a very parlous situation. So we know the likes of Philip Hammond and another departing minister, David Gawke, are not particularly keen or totally opposed to the idea of a no-deal Brexit. Even just the two of them and a couple more would cause the new Prime Minister a real headache. So they will be the people, the former establishment, that the new Prime Minister will look over their shoulder at rather nervously as they take up their new perches on the backbenches of the House of Commons.
But Boris Johnson will have some degree of momentum, having just been elected to the job that his predecessor hasn't had.
He will, and he'll need to make the most of that, because it won't necessarily last for very long. But yeah, he'll have a mandate. He expects to win, I think, pretty solidly and comfortably against his rival Jeremy Hunt in the leadership race. And crucially for a lot of Conservative MPs, he was a Brexiteer. He advocated Brexit in the referendum in the UK 3 years ago, unlike Theresa May. And so they believe that he believes in the project. And that could count for something, even though so many of the fundamentals around the parliamentary arithmetic and around the EU's reluctance to reopen the deal that was rejected so many times by British members of Parliament doesn't seem to show any sign of shifting as things stand.
Our political correspondent, Chris Mason. The UK government is seeking support from international allies to pressure Iran to release a British-flagged tanker which was seized in the Persian Gulf. Iran's Revolutionary Guard boarded the Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz on Friday, accusing the crew of colliding with a fishing boat. Iranian maritime officials are reported to have suggested it could be held for several weeks. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has been following developments.
Iranian television has broadcast pictures of the Stena Impero at anchor off the port of Bandar Abbas. It's flying an Iranian flag. A local official is quoted as saying the investigation into what happened on Friday could take a month or more. Another legal process is unfolding in Gibraltar, where the authorities are still holding a tanker, Grace 1, full of Iranian oil, which Britain believes was destined for Syria in breach of EU sanctions. Two investigations, then, which could stretch on for several weeks. In the meantime, the government is facing criticism for not doing more to protect British shipping. The Defence Minister, Tobias Elwood, speaking on Sky News, said there were limits to what Britain could do.
We simply cannot escort each individual ship. That is not a long-term solution to this. We need to recognise that there is a threat. We do need to provide solutions that allow shipping to continue. But ultimately, we need to focus on what is causing this, the geopolitical stress that Iran is actually engaging with.
Government officials have spent the weekend trying to figure out how best to respond. The Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, is due to update MPs. A freeze on Iranian assets in Britain has been discussed. But there aren't many here, so it's not thought this would prove all that effective. I understand Mr. Hunt will emphasise that Britain is working with other countries, including the United States, to improve maritime security. And he'll highlight the kind of diplomatic pressure that Britain is trying to muster. The Stena Impero is British-flagged, but Swedish-owned. The crew comes from all over the world. The tanker's international character, the government believes, should help to generate a multinational response.
Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reporting. The Trump administration in the US has been introducing new rules to reduce the number of Latin American asylum seekers. They include a system that makes migrants wait across the border in Mexico for their asylum applications to the US to be processed. And that means thousands of migrants are now stuck in the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez, where criminal gangs are rife. From there, Liam and Lima reports.
829, 830, 831. Mexican border guards call out the allotted numbers of the 20 or so migrants who are allowed to cross the border each day into El Paso in the U.S. to start their asylum applications. Under new American immigration rules, most are then sent back to Mexico to wait many months for their applications to be processed. The returns are a key part of President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy.
They told us that we'd get food and shelter and that we'd be in a safe place in Juarez. But when we arrived back in Mexico, we realized that it was a big lie. They literally throw you out onto the street with nothing.
Leandro, his wife, and 10-year-old daughter are among those to have been sent back across the border to wait in Ciudad Juarez. They are living in an abandoned house along with 15 other migrants. The family fled El Salvador in February after one of the country's violent gangs tried to recruit their son. Because he is 18, he was deemed to be an independent adult by the American authorities and detained in the U.S. His mother, Fran, says they still don't know where he is being held.
My child was taken away from me. We had never been separated before. I just hope he's well. My daughter said, "Don't cry, Mom," but how was I not going to cry when they separated me from my son?
Ciudad Juárez has one of Mexico's highest murder rates, and gangs are involved in drug and people trafficking and child prostitution. Leandro says a man recently tried to buy their daughter.
My wife, daughter, and I were out walking. A man came and asked me what we were doing. I said, "Looking for a job." He pointed at my daughter and said, "Why are you looking for a job? You have money already. How much do you want for her?"
Migrants are also kidnapped by gangs. They hope relatives will pay for the hostages to be released. The mayor of Ciudad Juárez, Armando Cavada, says his city is struggling to cope with the estimated 8,000 migrants who have so far been sent back from the U.S. and are waiting for their cases to be processed.
We're not prepared for this massive arrival of migrants because all of them demand public services, housing, work. What we have here is a virtual Trump's wall. He has not been able to build a physical wall, but he's built a virtual one, and obviously the Mexican government has been helping.
The mayor of Ciudad Juárez, Armando Cabada, ending that report from Liam and Lima. Japan's population is aging rapidly and shrinking. It's a nation that desperately needs more workers to fill jobs, and the problem has become more urgent because successive governments have been reluctant to take major steps. To get a sense of where Japan is heading, my colleague Martha Carney has been to a suburb in the north of Tokyo to meet women from three generations of one family. Hisako Maeda is 90. Her daughter, Teruko Hashimoto, is 68 and teaches English. She has two children. One of them is 31-year-old Sayori Nimura, and you may also hear the fourth generation, Joe, who's 13 months old. We start with Teruko.
My mom is 90 old, and I'm lucky to live with her. And I have two daughters, and the other one is still single, which I'm very sorry for. But
when you were growing up, was it normal for women to carry on working after they married?
Actually, when I left the high school, only four or five of us were going to the university or college.
So you were unusual.
Unusual.
And if I could ask your mother.
When I was young, it was probably less than half of the women who were working outside. Most of us were taking care of the house and listened to the mother-in-law. If the mother-in-law says of something very white, "Oh, this is black," you have to say, "Yes, mother," and leave the space for the mother to correct herself. It was a very strict way of life in Japan.
Teruko, obviously there have been big changes, big social changes in Japan over the decades, but family remains very important, doesn't it?
Yeah, as you know, Japan is a small country. We have no more lands to build houses on. That's why we need to live together in a small house with a few generations together.
But for Japan as a country, there are difficulties, aren't there, sometimes with people who are living so much longer with this aging society?
Yes. Old people have to care of more older people. That's the problem, I think. You have to earn some money to help. So no more free time for me, right?
Now, Sari, you've got a very lively toddler, 13-month-old Joe. Mm. What hopes do you have for his future?
First of all, good health. Second is, I want him to pursue something he loves, his passion. And in order to do that, just like my mother did for me, I want to be ready financially and provide the best conditions for him.
What are the big events that you've lived through in your life in Japan?
I remember in the year I was about to graduate university, that year was called an ice age for employment. So even if you got a job, it probably wasn't your dream job. And a lot of my friends around me purposely avoided getting enough credits to graduate so that they could wait until the economy was ready to hire them.
Hisako, you were born in 1928. You've lived through three emperors. What are your hopes for the new era?
I hope the imperial family will keep the way they are. A lot of things are changing. So I hope that they will go out to the world more, travel around more. I would like them to teach us about the world. That would be good.
90-year-old Hisako Maeda, and in that report from Martha Carney. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the podcast or the stories we chose, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.